This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Iraq launches operation to reclaim Anbar province. Organized crime making some big money in Mediterranean migration.
It's a ruthless travel agency. They work in networks and they can ally among themselves.
Japan's wartime past threatens UNESCO's World Heritage Sites. Taylor Swift's new song soars up the charts. These and other stories just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. The Iraqi government says it's launched an operation intended to retake the city of Ramadi and western Anbar province from Islamic State militants. The Tuesday announcement came less than 2 weeks after Islamist fighters took control of the provincial capital. Iraqi troops and pro-government militias have been positioned east of the city for an offensive to reclaim the largely Sunni province. VOA's Jeffrey Young spoke with Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institute in Washington, who has questions about the short-term effectiveness of the local forces.
It's hard to know just how the Iraqis will do in Ramadi against the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant anytime soon, because we just saw that they obviously had a big setback in Ramadi in recent days, and I think that setback was significant and was probably understated initially by President Obama and Secretary Kerry for what it told us about the state of the Iraqi army and even our overall strategy towards Iraq. Having said that, there certainly are some assets the government of Iraq can draw upon. Unfortunately, some of them are fairly unsavory, most of all the Shia militias, but there are elements of the Iraqi army that are improving. And I think that on balance, if you combine all those forces with American air power and the Kurdish Peshmerga, the long-term or medium-term future of Iraq is fairly promising. And ISIL, I believe, will be defeated. However, in the short term, it's very hard to know if it would be smart to actually undertake this kind of an operation primarily with the Shia militia. And it's not clear that anybody else is in a position to provide the predominant ground force. I don't think we really know. And I think Iraqis will be determining how this goes in coming days. The long term, I believe we can feel relatively confident about.
Well, behind the term Shia militia, we also have something a little bit more literal, and that is General Soleimani from Iran and Quds Force. Now, that changes the equation a lot because it is the hand of another state. It's also a force of another state. How do you see this in this combination of forces going up against the Islamic State at Anbar?
Well, I think it's a big problem that the Iranians have such a strong role, and I do think the Iraqi government has to watch this every step of the way. But I think the American position of a year ago, which was essentially a purist position that no Iranian role was tolerable, that American position was not realistic. And to some extent, the Iranian role was inevitable. And in fact, it may even have been in the short term beneficial because these militias probably helped save Baghdad last summer at a time when the Iraqi army was crumbling categorically. And so I think we have to be a little more nuanced in how we think about this and get back to first principles. The Iranian role in Iraq is likely to be strong. And some people say it's zero sum. And if it is, I think we're in a bit of a dilemma. I'm not so sure it has to be zero-sum. I'm not saying we're actually allies or that we can cooperate, that the Shia militias can be regulated, if they can be brought into a battle plan that's fashioned in Baghdad by the Iraqi army, and if over time the Iraqi army is on a trajectory to be stronger than any other fighting force in Iraq, I think that a short-term role for some of these Shia militias is tolerable.
Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington. I'm Jeffrey Young, VOA News.
Social media is reacting to Iraq's operation against Islamic State militants to retake Ramadi. Michael Lippin is here to tell us about what our VOA audience is saying about it.
Thanks, Ray. One of our top web stories today is about President Obama's admission that he needs to rethink the U.S. military assets that he has deployed in Iraq to fight the Islamic State militants. The article has two comments from readers based here in the U.S. Ruth L. from the southern state of Arizona criticizes Mr. Obama for having pulled out U.S. forces from Iraq at the end of 2011, saying he left Iraq to whoever wanted it and now faces the prospect of losing more American troops in the country should he send them there in the coming months. Another comment comes from Michael in Fresno, California. He writes, "It was a mistake for the U.S. to invade Iraq in 2003, and it was a mistake to stay on afterward. How much American equipment has the Islamic State group captured from the Iraqi army? Why should we provide more?" asks Michael. Moving to the Voice of America Facebook page, we posted a video there from Sunday of Iraqi government forces and their tribal allies in the city of Khaldiya near Ramadi. It's attracted quite a bit of interest, with more than 8,700 views, 280 likes, and 50 shares. Well, Ramadi also has been a hot topic on Twitter. Analytics website Topsy says Ramadi has been mentioned in at least 13,000 tweets over the past day. That's about the same as the number of Ramadi tweets in the past 5 days. The Ramadi tweets of the past day have a Topsy sentiment score of just 26 out of 100, meaning only about one quarter of those tweets are positive. That's perhaps a reflection that many Twitter users don't feel that good about the new Iraqi government offensive aimed at recapturing Ramadi. Ray, back to you.
Thank you, Michael. You can follow him on Twitter. His handle is at Michael_Lipin. That's L-I-P-I-N. Radical Islam is becoming a top security threat in many countries, but why are young people attracted to it? That's a big question facing France, where authorities estimate almost 1,500 people have left to join jihadist groups in the Middle East. A former Guantanamo Bay detainee may not have all the answers, but is on a campaign to change young minds. Lisa Bryant has details.
If Mourad Benchalali's life had gone as planned, he would not be here warning about the dangers of militant Islam. 14 years ago, he had a job and a fiancé. Then he went to Afghanistan, and his life turned upside down. He says his older brother tricked him into thinking it was a vacation. Instead, he ended up at an Al-Qaeda training camp, and a few months later, a prisoner at the U.S.-run detention camp in Guantanamo Bay. Today, Benchalali is back home in Vénissieux, a tough suburb of Lyon in central France. He's telling his story so young people will think twice before joining jihads in the Middle East.
Alors, ils n'auront pas toutes les réponses.
People don't find all the answers because every story is personal, but I help them find some keys.
Middle East and North Africa analyst Mansouria Mokefi says French authorities are also searching for answers.
The most important questions today are, why are these young people leaving France? And above all, what has failed in France to have the young people living for jihad?
These questions are being asked across the country, but especially in places like Vénissieux, where youth unemployment is high and drug dealers lurk in the shadows. It's here where Benchalali grew up and where his brother turned to radical Islam. Benchalali says he paid the price for his brother's deceit. He spent 30 months in Guantanamo before being transferred to French custody. He's written a book about his experience. He called it A Journey to Hell.
On disait de moi, à ma sortie de prison, que j'étais...
I was sick of hearing that I was a terrorist, a radical Islamist. I wanted to tell the truth. I wanted to tell my own story.
At first, few French were interested. That changed as fears grew about radical Islam. Today, housewife Sherazade Bouri is among those who believes Benchalali can help change young minds.
He's young himself, and he speaks frankly about what he endured.
But analyst Mokefi says that while Benchalali can make a difference, he's no match for the propaganda of Islamist extremists.
Yes, he can have an important role communicating, explaining, but dissuading, I'm not sure.
Benchalali has rebuilt his life. His ordeal is over. He's afraid that for others, it's only just beginning. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Vénissieux, France.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
This is VOA's International Edition. As migrants continue to die trying to cross the Mediterranean from North Africa, Europe says it wants to stem the flow by targeting the people smugglers. Experts, however, say such action would be difficult because of the vast web of organized crime that controls the trafficking. Henry Ridgewell's been following the migrant trail through Europe and has details.
Silhouetted against the Mediterranean sunrise, smugglers herd dozens of migrants from across Africa and the Middle East onto inflatable boats on a deserted North African beach. Offshore, they are loaded like cargo onto a larger vessel, which they hope will take them to Europe. In recent years, tens of thousands of migrants have died through drowning, starvation, and dehydration. The boat journey is just one stage of a vast network of people trafficking that starts in the country of origin. Andrea De Nicola, professor of criminology at the University of Trento in Italy, travelled across Africa and the Middle East, interviewing those involved in the smuggling network. VOA spoke to him at Milan Station, a major hub for migrants.
It's a ruthless travel agency. They work in networks and they can ally among themselves. And even if we close the route from Libya, they will probably work from Tunisia or Algeria or again from Turkey. They are flexible and they change.
Europe has called for targeted action against the people smugglers. Riccardo Fabiani of the Eurasia Group says that would be difficult, but not impossible.
The use of drones, for example, to target people involved in the smuggling business, let's say. And on the other hand, Italy and other European countries have intelligence networks in Libya that they can rely on for this kind of information.
The smugglers, however, are part of international crime syndicates earning huge sums, says De Nicola.
The United Nations estimate up to $10 billion. One Pakistani guy in Italy was smuggling 700 migrants and asked for each guy 7,000 euros.
Nearby, Mohammed scans the arrivals board in Milan Station. He's looking for his uncle, who fled the civil war in Syria and has come to Europe across the Mediterranean on a trafficker's boat. Mohammed is struggling to track him down. He was living close to the Yarmouk refugee camp in Damascus, says Mohammed. The situation there is well known. It's very difficult and dangerous. We got the news from Libya that he had departed and the boat had arrived in Europe. Despite the links to criminal gangs, it's clear the smugglers are providing a way out for Syrians and others fleeing conflict. That's why Europe must reform its migration policy, says De Nicola.
If you're gonna tighten Fortress Europe, probably they will increase prices. This is what these criminals told us. So in order to disorganize them, you need criminal law, you need investigation, but you also need prevention, reduction of opportunities, and of course a better policies for assisting victims.
Europe is determined to tackle the traffickers, but as the death toll in the Mediterranean rises, there is a growing debate over whether the continent should open safer channels for legitimate refugees fleeing war. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Milan, Italy.
You're listening to the Voice of America, broadcasting from Washington. Here are the latest headlines from VOA. I'm Victor Beatty. The White House says the Iraqi military mission to take back Ramadi from Islamic State and drive the militants from Anbar province clearly indicates the Iraqis have the will to fight. His comments follow those made Sunday by Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, who said the Iraqi retreat from Ramadi reflected an unwillingness to fight. At least 37 people are dead after the Islamist radical group Boko Haram assaulted a town in northeast Nigeria. Gunmen attacked the Borno state town of Gubbio late Sunday, setting off gun battles with security forces that lasted through the night, destroying hundreds of buildings, including mosques and schools. A heat wave in India has left more than 1,000 dead, and forecasters expect the punishing conditions to persist through the coming days. Hospitals are seeing a large number of patients suffering from sunstroke and dehydration, prompting officials to urge people to stay inside and avoid strenuous activity. That's the latest news. I'm Victor Beatty. South Korea is demanding that Japan acknowledge that Korean forced labor was used in the past at some sites that Tokyo would like added to the list of UNESCO World Heritage Sites. The UNESCO controversy is the latest development in a long-standing regional dispute over Japan's past wartime atrocities. VOA's Brian Patton has more.
The 23 sites being considered by UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, to be added to its World Heritage List include coal mines, steelworks, and shipyards that exemplify how Japan became the first Asian nation to enter the modern industrial age from 1850 to 1910. South Korea and China have objected to Japan's bid because they say it purposely distorts history by ignoring how thousands of Koreans were forced to work at these sites after 1910, when Japan's military conquered and imposed colonial rule throughout much of Asia. Recent talks between Seoul and Tokyo on this issue have so far failed to resolve the dispute. Japan's chief cabinet secretary, Yoshihide Suga, said the UNESCO-nominated sites should be considered separate from the ongoing regional dispute over the atrocities committed during Japan's military occupation of Asia in the first half of the 20th century. Suga says they should not politicize this issue. South Korean and Chinese officials have voiced opposition to seven of these sites, where some 60,000 laborers from Korea and China were reportedly forced to work long hours and under dangerous conditions. Among the sites is the island of Hashima off Nagasaki that was an undersea coal mine. Today, it is desolate and virtually uninhabited and was a featured location as a villain stronghold in a recent James Bond film. South Korea and China see Japan's carefully constructed World Heritage Site narrative that excludes any involvement in past abuse as part of a pattern. They point out Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's reluctance to offer a strong apology for Japan's wartime atrocities that include forcing thousands of women into prostitution. Robert Kelly, an international relations professor at Pusan National University in South Korea, says Japan's critics have a valid complaint.
When Koreans are terribly shrill about this, and they demonize Japan far too much, but I can understand why. I mean, the Japanese have a terrible tendency not to admit these kinds of things.
Prime Minister Abe has said he will uphold statements by past leaders that offered apologies for Japanese misconduct during the war. But he stirred the controversy when he visited a World War II shrine that includes some Japanese war criminals. South Korean President Park Geun-hye has refused to meet with her Japanese counterpart until he makes a sincere apology for past wartime abuse. But at the same time, the two Asian democracies continue to cooperate on regional security and trade issues. The World Heritage Committee is expected to render a decision on Japan's UNESCO request during a meeting in Germany at the end of June. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
Coming up, pop singer Taylor Swift's new song making a smash debut.
Trending on the web, it's Action Reaction.
A number of celebrities are 50 this year. Brooke Shields got an early start in show business in an ad for Ivory Soap before she was 1 year old. The now grown-up star of the 1980 movie Blue Lagoon is still making heads turn after 50 years as a model actor. Funny man Chris Rock turns 50. Rock began his comedy career at the New York club To Catch a Rising Star in 1984. God save Elizabeth Hurley, who plays the Queen of England on her new show, The Royals. Even at 50, she looks less like Queen Elizabeth and more like Duchess Kate. Robert Iron Man Downey Jr. also turns half a century old.
That's quite a triptych.
No rust on this Iron Man, just a few distinguished gray hairs. And finally, Ben Stiller, whose comedic pedigree might be called stellar, with comedy duo Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira as parents. Ben turns 50 this year. Sadly, though, Ann Mira passed away May 23rd. For VOA's Action Reaction, I'm Philip Alexio.
Hundreds of Russian warplanes and thousands of troops began a major military exercise Tuesday, coinciding with Arctic maneuvers by NATO forces. The separate exercises come at a time of increased tensions between Russia and the West. Russia's exercises stretch from the Volga River to Siberia and are due to last 3 days. American pop singer Taylor Swift has the highest debut single this week for her song Bad Blood. Only two other songs, including Swift's Shake It Off back in August, have debuted higher. VOA's David Byrd and Larry London stopped by to chat about Swift's new song and video and her career.
'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. You know it used to be mad love. So take a look what you've done. 'Cause baby, now we got bad blood. Hey, now we got problems. And I don't
she just upset the world's apple cart when she debuted her new video, Bad Blood, on the Billboard Music Awards recently. We're talking about Taylor Swift. This is the fourth single off of her new album, 1989, and it is absolutely lighting up the pop music world. Joining me to talk about it, Larry London. Larry, Taylor has taken the film noir genre in this video and just kind of turned it on its head. I mean, she's got stars and supermodels and all kinds of stuff blowing up, you know. So what is it with this song? Is it intended to be aimed at anybody, or is this just kind of a...
Interesting question, David, because there are those that believe that this song was inspired by Taylor's feud with Katy Perry, which started with this backup dancer thing that Katy went and hired some of Taylor's backup dancers. So Taylor's upset and wrote a song called Bad Blood. There are those that believe that. I'm not sure that I buy into that. But you never know. But everything that Taylor touches turns to gold. She's the it girl right now. And in most cases, everything she touches turns to platinum. In fact, she just came off of 8 Billboard Music Award wins, now surpassing Garth Brooks. She's got 20. He had 19. So she holds the all-time record. So everything she does is just amazing.
She's also got Kendrick Lamar rapping on this particular cut.
Tap.
And he's you know, a force of nature to be reckoned with,
yes,
as well.
And for rap in a Taylor Swift song, a year ago, this wouldn't have been possible, but she defied her bosses who said, "No, let's stick in the country music lane." She said, "No, we're gonna change lanes. I believe in doing something different." She did it, and look, I mean, it's amazing. As you said, fourth single's taking off, 20-plus million views on Vivo in a 24-hour period. She broke the Vivo View record.
One of those broke the internet videos, too.
Unbelievable. Everything she's doing is just amazing, and I like this song, too.
Yeah, now let's run down some of the ladies that she has joining her in this particular tune. Her BFF, Karlie Kloss, the supermodel, of course.
Mm-hmm.
She has Ellie Goulding, who's holding a rocket-propelled grenade in this particular video. Lena Dunham, Jessica Alba, Ellen Pompeo from Grey's Anatomy.
Grey's Anatomy, yeah. Dr. Grey.
Selena Gomez plays her arch rival, who is called Arson, and begins the video by kicking Taylor out the window of a high-rise building. And Cindy Crawford as the headmistress of this place, where Taylor is doing all this martial arts training and everything else.
She's just amazing. Everything she does, whether it be videos or songs, it's just, you know, you can't stop the girl. She's, like I said, hot right now. And hopefully she'll continue to stay clean and stay in the lane that she's in as a great role model and a person that everybody seems to look up to. She can do no wrong.
Life is not always easy when you're sitting on that golden throne, right?
That's right. She's in People magazine right now. They quoted her on an interview she did with the BBC Radio 1, And she spoke about what is the hardest part in her career these days. And she said, the hardest part of my career is not being a superstar. It's being away from my cats.
Really?
Yes, her cats, Meredith and Olivia.
So are you a Taylor Swift fan? Have you seen the video for Bad Blood? We'd love to know what you think. You can send us your comments and your questions on our website, voanews.com. We are also on Facebook. We're facebook.com/Voice of America.
And that'll do it for this edition of International Edition. There's plenty more to see, read, and hear on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The governments of the United States and Lao PDR presented a multilateral wildlife trafficking workshop in Vientiane from May 6th to 8th. The workshop included investigators and prosecutors from Indonesia, Lao PDR, Malaysia, Thailand, and Vietnam. Ambassador Daniel A. Clune of the U.S. Embassy in Vientiane and Director General Kamput Pandanuvong of the Lao Department of Forest Inspection opened the workshop on May 6th. In his opening remarks, Ambassador Clune highlighted the importance of the participants' work. Wildlife trafficking is a serious concern, with illicit proceeds estimated at $8 to $10 billion annually. Increasingly, wildlife trafficking is intertwined with other illicit activities that undermine national security and economic prosperity. Combating wildlife trafficking requires collaborative actions and cooperation. The Laos Wildlife Trafficking Workshop is the third in a series of regional wildlife trafficking law enforcement workshops supported by the United States Department of State's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, or INL. The first workshop was held in Bogor, Indonesia, in May 2014. The second was held in Hanoi in November 2014. The workshops provide an opportunity for officials from participating countries to discuss policy, information sharing, and enforcement issues. Ultimately, the workshop offers participants an opportunity to improve regional cooperation to combat wildlife trafficking and other illicit activities of transnational criminal organizations. These workshops are just one aspect of the strengthened commitment of the United States to support efforts to stop wildlife trafficking and protect endangered species around the world. In July 2013, President Obama signed an executive order that resulted in the first U.S. national strategy for combating wildlife trafficking. The strategy incorporates the efforts of over 17 U.S. government agencies and sets three strategic priorities: strengthening enforcement, reducing demand, and building international cooperation. We're proud to be able to work together with our Lao partners on endeavors such as these, said Noah Gieseman, acting director for the INL section at the U.S. Embassy. The Department of Forest Inspection has been extremely supportive, he said. We hope that all the participants will be able to use this three-day workshop to build a stronger network of partnerships across Southeast Asia, and that our nations can continue to work together against wildlife traffickers and transnational crime.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.